Welcome to Theory of Creativity, where we discuss the tools, techniques, and ideas for growing arts, culture, and creativity in our world. My name is Tandy Palmer-Williams, and I'm founder and managing director of a research agency called Pattern Makers. In this series, I join with colleagues from theatre, dance, music, visual arts, literature, and heritage to speak with experts in research, business, economics, technology, and policy. We talk about the challenges facing arts and cultural organisations today, like engaging audiences, securing funding, and creating positive impacts through our work. I want to help grow your organisation bigger, better, and stronger so that collectively we can do even more good in the world. In today's episode, I'm talking with Stephen Wolfe, Director of AMS Planning and Research. It's a part of a new season of Theory of Creativity, supported by Creative Victoria, centered around the idea of real change and renewal. We'll be exploring the tools, techniques, and ideas we can harness to build a newly thriving arts and culture sector post-pandemic and even herald in the next renaissance. Let's get into it. Stephen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tandy. Excited to be here.
To start, tell us what you do at AMS and what you're best known for and a little bit of the journey to now.
AMS Planning and Research is an arts consultancy based in the U.S. We've been around for about 30 years. I started when I was 7 years old, so don't let the white hair fool anybody. we work primarily with large institutions in communities, though, of all sizes. So large in a small town in Vermont is very different than large in Manhattan. And we've had the good fortune over the years to get to a few cities around the world. I've spent a lot of time in Australia in the major cities, and it's a favorite place of mine to work and visit. But it's great to see what you're doing there, and particularly the support for this kind of exchange. I'm delighted to be here with you today.
So AMS, tell us about what you offer and who you work with.
So AMS has sort of three areas of primary work. We do an awful lot of capital facility development from concept to implementation. So we're deeply involved in not so much the design process, although we're present, but in what are we going to have when we're done and how do we make it work successfully? So the governance aspects of it, the project development aspects of it, and the impact of project design on future operations. You know, all too often people set out to build a new theater or a gallery or whatever, and they're surprised when it's delivered that they don't know how to run it. So capital facility development is where we started. I actually personally came out of the theater consulting sector, doing management consultant work for big theater consulting firms, which was generally around feasibility studies. And the interesting question became, if you're asking the question, if you build it, will they come? Maybe the people who want to build it shouldn't be asking the question. That created the space that we built AMS into. As a result of all that work, we made a transition into strategic planning and organizational development work. And we've been really involved for 20 years or more, helping organizations think about how they can be impactful and successful. We use a term here, we use the term vitality. How can we create vital organizations? In my work in Australia, I've had some funny conversations because sustainable is the word that you all prefer to use for organizations that are able to continue. But that's our strategic planning work. And then we have a data practice called AMS Analytics that we've had for quite a long time that's deeply involved in operations benchmarking, primarily for large performing arts centers. We run a big international database there, and has been a partner like you with Wolf Brown in the Audience Outlook Monitor work. So data has been, I think, one of our core tenets for a long time. We don't think that necessarily our team of 13 or 14 people are the smartest in the world, have the biggest vision in the world, but we try to bring together data and thinking and ideas from the field and make that manifest.
Well, you're certainly regarded as among the best in the world at doing so. So congratulations on building such a thriving practice. And I'm sure we could have a whole nother episode on AMS Analytics. That sounds fascinating. But we're here today to talk about
I guess that this era that we find ourselves in, the pandemic is here, and we're looking at now the case for change and transformation in the arts and culture sector. And I've been really excited to have this conversation because of a paper that you released in the early days of the pandemic. You must have been writing very fast at that point. It's really designed for anchor institutions, as you call them, and it's titled The Long Runway to Return. So tell us what you were thinking about at that time. What do you mean by anchor institutions, and why the title The Long Runway?
So there's at least three or four questions there, so prompt me when I leave one or the other out. When the pandemic hit and the field shut down pretty much instantly, right? March the 12th here in America. On the 11th, I was in Canada. On that day, it's the last time I've flown in a year, almost. And there was a lot of concern in our sector, particularly about how could we survive a shutdown? What were the economics? And we felt, in fact, that there were some underlying issues. We have an image that we use when we talk about this, about when the tide goes out, that you see the rocks that were already there. So social justice, shifting priorities in philanthropy, competition and consumer behavior change were big critical issues for our sector even before the pandemic hit. Social justice and racial equity was a huge topic even before the pandemic hit. And then we got shut down. And what we found is that people were so focused on the pandemic and the economic disaster that it is, that perhaps they were losing sight of the other opportunities or the other issues that might, in fact, you know, the Chinese have two brushstrokes for crisis. One is concern and the other is opportunity. I don't think that's the exact right quote. It's in the paper. But what a great time during this pause to think about what are we really about? And this is work that we've been doing with support from the Mellon Foundation in partnership with Karen Brooks Hopkins, who was the president of the Brooklyn Academy of Music for a really long time, around anchor institutions, which you mentioned. So anchor institutions is a notion that's been in cities for quite a long time, around universities, hospitals, government establishments, sort of place-based organizations that, unlike the baseball team or the football team, can't pick up and go to some other city that builds them a new stadium or gives them a better deal. That logic had not been applied to cultural institutions. And we started with a premise that it actually applied to large cultural institutions. And as we did the research, we came to discover that it wasn't necessarily about scale. It was about the way the organization was integrated into the community. So you could be Brooklyn Academy of Music, which has been at the heart of the reimagination of the Fort Greene part of Brooklyn, some good, some bad, issues of cultural expansion offset by gentrification, not always a good thing. Or you could be little AS220 in Providence, Rhode Island, who has a sort of 30-year history of artist as squatter and changemaker, and be fundamental to that place and completely tied into that place. And it aligned with a notion that we had about changing measures of success. So when the not-for-profit sector came to be in the mid-20th century at scale, around the Western world in particular, the metrics of success were really around art for art's sake, right? Quality measures. Is it the best possible art? We went through a couple of evolutions where it became about efficiency, right? Are we running it like a business? That's when I came into the field, and I always thought that was ironic because they'd created a whole corporate and tax structure that was about not running like a business and then saying, but you need to run like a business. Then we went into this interesting time about effectiveness. Are we having an impact? Can we stop counting the outputs that we have and actually look at the change we're trying to make? I think which was a really productive step forward. Then we started thinking about it, and you mentioned this in our earlier conversation. We think the measure now is what we call community entanglement or entanglement. We stole it from quantum physics. In quantum physics, there's a condition where the particles, the atomic particles, are so active and interacting, you can't tell them apart one from the other. And the notion of thinking about cultural institutions or even cultural systems in communities, we frame it up with the thought that if you went away, you would be missed, is this notion of entanglement. And that aligned with these existing definitions of anchor institutions and allowed us to say, hey, wait a minute, cultural organizations and cultural systems are in fact civic anchors, and therefore they should be at the table with the other anchor institutions in the community when public policy is made, when social policy is developed. It expands the argument candidly beyond, oh, we have an economic impact and we create jobs, or, oh, we provide entertainment opportunities, or we employ artists. It actually gets to the core health of the place. And that's a compelling argument with mayors or governors or whoever.
Well, I love that phrase, community entanglement. I think it's far preferable to community engagement, which who knows what that even means anymore, engagement. But let's talk about the long runway and the complexity that anchor institutions are now facing as we look to rebuild after the pandemic and what that is looking like for those big anchor institutions.
I think there's two parts of it. You know, in the paper, we charted out a sort of very linear diagram about a resilience phase and a readiness phase, a reimagination phase, recapitalization, and then return. And the benefit of now about 8 months of hindsight is, first of all, it isn't a straight line. I think that we picked that up from some other notions of progressions. And the more important question is, I think it's become very, very clear to us that it's not about return to what we think normal used to look like. We think it's a real opportunity for transformation. And in fact, I'm working on the sequel to the paper, which actually we call the long runway return or transformation. And the original impulse was that while we shut down very quickly, there was no way we were going to just turn back on one day. And the thought was initially about the fact that the arts and culture sector, and primarily here I'm looking at North America, and you could tell me if it applies in Australia, New Zealand. We've seen a lot of it in Europe from some of the reporting, although the governments in Europe stepped in so significantly early on, it's a little different. What we had here was a lot of organizations that weren't sure how long they were going to be shut down for, didn't reduce their operating costs dramatically right up at the front. In fact, tried very hard to be a sort of economic bridge for a long time. And they were consuming capital and reserves at a great rate of speed when they weren't generating any revenue. And our initial concern was that when we got over the health crisis, which was going to be in 6 months at that point in time, that the organizations would be under-resourced to reopen because, in fact, they'd have to start over, right? Mounting new productions, curating new exhibitions, wherever it was. And that's where our initial focus was. As the pandemic extended, organizations started to scale back, started to protect capital, started to think about interim revenue streams. Finally, particularly in America, we got some programs like the PPP, and now we're very, very excited about this new Shuttered Venues Operators funding that we have, $15 billion worth of U.S. $15 billion for live arts organizations, and museums, which is more support than the U.S. federal government's ever exhibited for the arts and culture sector. We began to think about, for these organizations, that there were two other things that happened. We discovered that in the case of a lot of them, that the producing organizations had content that they could convert or distribute digitally, but presenters and venues actually didn't. They were brands and centers, but they were at a loss for what to offer while the theaters were closed, particularly, or while the galleries were closed. The second thing that we began to realize is that there was no way we were going back to where we were for two reasons. One, all of those other rocks at low tide that were there before the pandemic are still here, and in fact, in many cases, are much more important and much more central to the conversation. Equity and social justice in particular, but also questions about capacity, about service delivery, we can go into in a second if you want. And also because when the switch goes back on, when we have permission to get to 100% capacity, we're not going to have 100% of the audience ready to return. And we think that could take a long time. When we look backwards to the global financial crisis, 2008, 2009, early 2010, the data tell us that it wasn't until 2016, 2017 that on an inflation-adjusted basis that most organizations had recovered to where they were before. And I think that was a surprise to everybody in hindsight, because certainly there was growth, there was expansion in content, expansion in participation. But when you level it out, you discover that actually it took a really long time to get back to quote unquote normal. And that was a 35% decline in activity. We have effectively 100% decline in activity with the pandemic. And so how we get back up, we think, is going to be a series of stair steps. And that means we're going to have to think about how we restaff. We're going to have to think about how we mount productions. We're going to have to think about our partnerships, our organizations. I'm fairly convinced. I have a little diagram that's, you know, if we look like this nice little pyramid before, the pandemic has blown it into a million little bits. And I don't think those bits are going to come back into this nice little pyramid. I think it's going to be a highly decentralized organization. We're going to have new kinds of partners. For example, we have large regional theaters that have complexes with three or four theaters in them. They're not going to be able to activate all those theaters when they reopen. And there's a whole bunch of other theaters in the city who won't have their venues anymore. How can they share space? How can we address the question of brand, for example, in a complex that's been occupied by one theater company that might now have three or four or five, which, by the way, then serves a whole bunch of other goals around equity and accessibility that are really important. So there's a giant opportunity to rethink how we use our physical assets. It's a giant opportunity to think about the relationships between governance and philanthropy, which certainly in America are right like this, less so in Australia. But I think that those are just two examples of the opportunities that I think are out there to transform how these organizations work.
Hearing you speak, it certainly resonates, because I think what we're seeing is not just a health crisis, but an economic crisis as well. And certainly, you know, a social crisis in many ways. I think what we have seen in the past 12 months, not just with COVID-19, but certainly social movements around Black Lives Matter. I could continue listing them, but certainly there's a need for anchor institutions to be vehicles for social change and social justice. But let's talk a minute in terms of some of what you've observed since the release of the paper. Are there successes that we can already start to celebrate? And what are kind of the most interesting examples or the organizations who are being really ambitious in their thinking right now? Tell us what excites you about what you've observed.
I think there's actually been a lot of success during this time. I mean, I think there are groups of people who are sort of ignoring it. You know, as you and I talked earlier, there's some people who are just, it'll be fine. We just have to make it till when we come back. But there's also been some organizations that have really used this time to be thoughtful and change-based. And talk about a couple. We're working with a 177-year-old museum that is as traditional an encyclopedic museum, with all of the burdens that they have about assets whose provenance may or may not be right, or whatever the right way to say it is, in a community that is now over 70% people of color. And they're using this time to do strategic planning to say, how can we make a transition to become more community-facing, more community-engaged, less fortress-like? And it's impacting the organization from top to bottom. So the goals that they're looking at are, while they're about art and art making, they're also about storytelling. They're also about cultural transformation and leadership, and literal transformation of leadership. And they're really using this time to deeply engage with partners that had sort of been around, but are now they're in deep conversation with and addressing fundamental questions. And we have a colleague of mine, Lynette Turner, who's been running some implicit bias workshops between a predominantly African-American institution and this museum to help them actually be able to have a conversation together. And that's really exciting to see that kind of work taking place at a community level. Another example, a big performing arts center in the Southeast, almost brand new, less than 5 years old, hundreds of millions of dollars of investment shut down. Just launched, and fortunately because it's warm, an outdoor venue, a front yard they call it, where they're going to do 500 different events between January and June in a socially distanced setup, where they've partnered with 16 different restaurants who have put food trucks there that they can deliver from. They've partnered with the YMCA to do fitness classes in the morning. They've partnered with the hospital group to do wellness programming midday. And this notion of the whole arc of the community's well-being is exactly what an anchor institution is about. Some of the larger theater companies in America that we're working with or are just working on their own, really actively engaged in questions about their role in addressing social justice questions and the like. And I think that that's a really important transformation, a lot of thinking going on. It's an interesting time, right? Because a lot of people in our sector are unfortunate and actually not working as much as they used to work. But they're giving back by thinking and engaging and trying to motivate change. And while that's certainly been difficult in many, many places, it's really productive because it's focusing on this next question about why are we here?
So let's talk about now, I guess, some of the challenges that we're seeing and the opportunities that yet exist for transformation. On a practical level, how does, say, a director working inside an anchor institution or maybe it's a board member, how do we make sure we don't waste this crisis? What are some of the practical things that, people working inside these large institutions can actually be doing to make sure we don't go back to how things were and waste the moment?
Clearly, right, Winston Churchill's quote, right? Never let a good crisis go to waste. It would be a shame if all we did was return. And that's just for me, that's a big difference, right? That's what I was looking at 8 months ago. How do we return? I think we need to change the fundamental question we're asking. And I think it needs to shift from what do we do and how do we do it to why do we do it? And this notion of purpose, and it's been written about fairly broadly, but I think that stakeholders and investors, be they literally financial partners or artistic partners, it's a different question. The challenge of the 20th century was to democratize access to arts and culture, to push it out of the big cities, to get it into communities and across states and countries, into the remotest parts of the community and the most populous. And that was a market-based kind of question. I think that the real opportunity here is to ask the question, why do we make theater? Why do we run a museum? Why are we supporting artists? Whatever the particular angle is, because if you can get to why, you can begin to think about what success looks like. And I think we've kind of lost sight about that. We've gotten really good at counting, right? If a lot of people come, we're successful. If the books balance, we're successful. Well, but then it's just a math exercise, right? But what's the impact we hope to have? What's the change we're trying to support? What's the civicness we're trying to encourage? And if you really think about why and defining success, then you get to create a destination. And, my second book, haven't written my first book, my second book will be All Clichés Are True. And chapter 7 is, without a destination, all roads lead there, right? So you can sort of do whatever you want to do. And I think that stakeholders in particular are calling on us to be much more intentional, to understand what our destination is, to be steadfast in pursuing it, and from time to time say, we accomplished it, and we don't need to be here anymore, right? We're just not necessarily permanent, which was certainly a goal for a long time. But so I think that's the biggest question, opportunity, Tandy, is to switch the question from what are we doing to why are we doing it. And once we know why we're doing it, then we can think about what we should do and how we should do it and where we should do it, and so on. I think another huge opportunity here is to take advantage of the disruption, to think about what it means to be entangled in your community. And in fact, we're trying hard to stop using the word community, because there's nothing monolithic about it, right? What does it take to be entangled with the communities that you hope to serve? And I think that's another pretty fundamental change, right? And it's a really difficult one, because it talks about creating access and equity for people who didn't traditionally have that in our sector. And so a lot of thinking going on there. So that's probably the second biggest opportunity. The third one, I think, is structural. I think that we have to go away from hierarchical siloed organizations and move to much more matrix kind of organizations with decentralized partnerships. There's a very interesting conversation going on here in the US and Canada, maybe as well in Australia, about decoupling governance and philanthropy, right? Here, where the not-for-profit sector is so dependent on private generosity, write me a check, you go on the board. And what if I don't really want to be on the board? Or what if I'm not really effective at being on the board, but I'm really generous? And we've made those pretty synonymous. And I think we have a real opportunity to see if there are different structures. And in fact, just earlier today, I was talking to a very small organization who said, I'm really great at raising money, but nobody comes to board meetings. And it's like, you know, the woman who's the executive said, I feel like I'm alone. And it's like, well, yeah, well, because you put Jane Gottbucks on the board because she wrote you a really big check. You put Joe writes checks on the board because he was generous and wrote you a check, but they don't see their role as more than that. And how can we push that forward? Now that's going to upset the traditional fundraising cart like there's no tomorrow. And I probably a lot of fundraising consultants, if you're watching this, that will not like me very much. But I actually think that finding a structure that honors and respects and engages philanthropy in one way and recognizes that governance is a different structure is going to be a huge opportunity to increase impact and understand why, you know, act on why we're doing what we're trying to do. So those would be my three big buckets.
Can I just ask you for, I guess, a really practical step that someone could take to, maybe it's around this idea of why, that they could take tomorrow or in their next big strategic planning meeting perhaps, or is it a technique that someone can apply in terms of managing a team? I'm not sure, but I'd really love to hear whether it's something simple or a bigger exercise of something practical that a director inside an organization could take to really focus on the why and not the what.
For both of us, right, it would certainly be good as consultants to say it's really complicated and you need outside help. I actually think that there's a really simple exercise, two, that I'll suggest. One is to ask the question, what is success and how do we measure it? Now, it might be for somebody that's, we sell a lot of seats or we use the theater a lot of days or, you know, the gallery is open for a lot of hours. But I also think for some other organizations, particularly for younger artistic leaders and emerging leaders, there's a whole different set of questions about why, and articulating that and describing it in how will I know when I achieve it would be really, really important. Like, I mean, so important, like put it on the wall, paint it onto the wall. The second thing I think that is a really easy exercise to do, and I think I've talked about this a little bit with some of the performing arts centers there. Two professors from Harvard, Dutch Leonard and Mark Moore, have something they call the strategic triangle. And they say that high-performing not-for-profits and non-governmental organizations find success at the intersection of value, capacity, and support. And it's a pretty simple concept. Do we have the capacity to deliver whatever it is we deliver? Are there direct or indirect payers for that? Is there support? And does it create value, particularly public value? Does it make place better? And a really interesting exercise we do with a lot of clients, list all of your programs down the first column, head the next three columns, capacity, support, and value, and see if you can check all of those boxes. And if you can't actually check all of those boxes, you should be asking yourself a question, why do we do this program? You know, and what you find, oh, well, we've been doing it for 20 years. Or, you know, we thought it was going to generate revenue. I think that question of where do you find success, and that's two ways to get to that question, right? Why do we do what we do? And do we have the capacity that drives support to create value are great ways to look at an institution and think about how it might want to transform itself and be different.
So we're coming up to the end of our time together, but I'm really curious just to ask you a little bit more about what a successful, or perhaps it's a vital, or we were joking about sustainable before, but what does a vital anchor institution look like post-pandemic? You know, when you close your eyes and really visualize, say it is 7 years into the future, when we're kind of in that post-pandemic era, what do the most successful anchor institutions look like? What are some of the things that will be visible to an outsider when they observe an Encar institution in 7 years' time and think they're doing a fabulous job? That's a really exciting institution.
So I'd like to divide it into two parts, and I may need you to prompt me because I'll get wrapped up in one and forget the other. I think there's going to be stuff that we'll be able to see and touch, and I think that will change, and I think there's going to be internal evolution, which I'd like to make sure we talk about. I think anchor institutions, and again, I want to say as I did at the beginning, not necessarily big, right? But community entangled, important organizations. I think the first thing that we'll notice is different is that they'll be approachable. A lot of our arts and cultural institutions have what we call threshold anxiety. And particularly in the bigger buildings, we, in the 20th century as a field, and I'm complicit in this, I'm sure, we got so focused on architecture and iconicness and brand that we made our buildings very, very hard to approach. You know, my favorite story, being a theater person, not an orchestra person, is I still don't understand why they leave the lights on if they don't want you to read the program and unwrap your candy. That some of these rules that have grown up over time will change, and our organizations will become much more approachable at a human scale, both physically and operationally. I have a wonderful artistic director friend who said to me, I can't just mount the play anymore and think everybody's going to get it. I need to help them understand, whether it's through questions or through answers, the message that we're trying to deliver. Why are we setting Hamlet in New York City and Central Park in the Vietnam era? There's a story. Michael Tilson Thomas, who did a wonderful evening of work, the conductor of the San Francisco Symphony at Carnegie Hall, called The Music of Shakespeare. Well, there was no music of Shakespeare. But what was it that he was trying to communicate? And interestingly, in New York during the run, he started talking to the audience and explaining why he had named the program. I think it's a phenomenal example of how we'll see organizations differently. I think that we're going to see the curve change. I think we're going to get some really big brands. I think we're going to get folks that have both live and digital distribution capacity, the National Theater of Great Britain out of London, or the Met Live kind of thing, that are going to be really, really big brands. And they're not going to be place specific anymore. I also think at the other end of the spectrum, we're going to see real grassroots, non-structured, not needing to be corporate, moving amoeba-like alliances of artists and administrators making work in a moment and then going on to another project. I think it's going to be very interesting in the middle. I really do. I think in the it's an odd curve in our sector. So those, I think, are some of the more obvious and visible external things. Internally, I think that we're going to see a giant generational change. I mean, the time of this pandemic and the tenure of a lot of leaders is just, it's coincidental, but there's going to be a lot of change, I think, particularly at major institutions around the world. I think that's going to bring forth questions about how organizations should be structured, what the hierarchies look like, what the relationships look like. I'm very, very hopeful there's going to be much more authentic voice at the table, at all of the tables. And, you know, Australia, of course, leading the way in some of those conversations.
So when you say authentic voice, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, whether it's the community that you're in, and it's, you know, you're in a community that's 70% people of color, and it's arts organizations ought to reflect that. Or it's companies that are built around the work of particular artists or artists, that we're going to find this shift in this governance and support piece that's out there. I think the other thing that's going to be really important internally is a degree of flexibility that we just grew out of as a sector. You know, the sector matured from the mid-20th century to the turn of the century. It got very corporate, and as in so many other things that do, it got kind of set in its ways. And one of the characteristics, I believe, of the entangled anchor institution is an organization that's appropriately resourced in every way: financial resources, human resources, political resources, social resources, to adapt and change. I think we're going to discover that the cycle spins faster, that the rate of change increases, and being able to be adaptable It's why I have fun with sustainable versus vital. You know, sustainable to me is that thing in the airport where you drop your coin in and it spins around and spins around and spins around. And as long as you're watching it, it keeps spinning around. All of a sudden it drops to the bottom. Vital is really about being able to adapt and change and to do it without institutional threat. And I think that's going to be probably the most important internal transformation, to stick with the theme that we started with at the top, that we're going to want to make.
Stephen, thank you so much. So many good ideas there to spark the thinking that is so needed. So for those listening, I really encourage you to have a read of Stephen's paper, The Long Runway, if you haven't, and I'll pop a link in the show notes, or you can simply Google it, The Long Runway, AMS, and it should pop up for you. Stephen, I just want to ask, for those who are interested to find out more about your work or the ideas that we've talked about today, where would you send them and how can people get in touch with you if they are keen to reach out directly?
Well, it'd be wonderful. And you know, as you've witnessed here, I think with my lips, I love to talk. The more people who I get to talk to, the more I learn, because there's so many smart people out there. We have a great team. Easy to find us at www.ams-online.com, whatever device, whatever place, wherever you are. You know, reach out, email, phone, Zoom. We'd love to connect, and we're pretty easy to find.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and just enjoyed really, Tandy, getting to know you through our other conversations. And hello to all my friends in Australia.
Well, I'm sure they'll be pleased to hear about our conversation today. We'll definitely be looking out for your new upcoming paper, Transformational Return. We'll be sure to push that out through our socials when the time comes. Thank you, Stephen, again.
So there you have it. I feel like we barely scratched the surface there, but there was so much to think about. My top takeaways were, number one, that vital anchor institutions aren't defined by their scale, but in how integrated they are or entangled they are in the community. Number two, that we should definitely be saying communities rather than community, because there's nothing monolithic about it. Number three, that anchor cultural institutions should be at the table with the other anchor institutions in the community when public policy is made, and that their role goes much deeper than simply providing entertainment or employing local people, but really serving that whole arc of community well-being. Number four, that those organizations using this time for meaningful transformation are doing things like forging new partnerships, using their assets to respond to community needs, and even exploring this idea of the decentralized art center. Number five, that stakeholders are calling on us to be much more intentional right now, and that we need to shift from defining what we do and how we do it to why we do it. The notion of purpose must come before all else, and we should even be painting it on our walls. Number six, and that adaptability and being able to change without institutional threat is the most important internal transformation that will see us thrive in a future where the pace of change just continues to accelerate. Thank you for joining me for the first episode in this new season of Theory of Creativity, supported by Creative Victoria, focused on real change and renewal. We've got more stimulating conversations coming your way, so see you next month.
If you heard something that you want to know a little bit more about, you can visit the show notes. These are a set of resources that my team compile on every episode, including the guest bios, key points covered, and useful links to resources mentioned in the conversation. You can access these at our website, www.thepatternmakers.com.au/theory of creativity, one word. Now, if you've made it to this point, then I have a favour to ask. Will you take 30 seconds to rate and review Theory of Creativity? And if you hit subscribe, you'll be helping more people hear these ideas, techniques, and tools so that collectively we can do even more good in the world. Sound like a plan? This project has been assisted by the Australian Government through the Australia Council, its arts funding and advisory body. It has been produced in collaboration with arts leaders around Australia. You know who you are. Thank you so much for your support. We'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners upon whose lands this podcast is made, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. And we want to acknowledge First Nations people everywhere.